Well, it's a real pleasure to be here again, so thank you for the invite. I want to start off talking about one of my personal heroes, somebody that's been able to maintain a certain sense of peacefulness and calm throughout a very tumultuous life. Okay. And very horrific circumstances. This person is Nelson Mandela. When speaking about reconciliation in South Africa, he had this to say: "I had never lost hope that this great transformation would occur, because I always knew that deep down in every human heart there is mercy and generosity. No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin, or his background, or his religion. If people can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite." He's pointing to inner qualities. Qualities that we all have. In every human heart, there's mercy and generosity. And that comes to the heart more naturally than its opposite, or hate. This is the same message that I get from the Buddha. That our task is not to remake ourselves, okay? But rather to understand, to uncover, and to realize that which is already there. And the Buddha pointed to a way that each of us can clear out and walk down that path. A path to mercy, to generosity, to loving kindness, to compassion, to peace. The way is through mindfulness. And what is mindfulness? It's simply being non-judgmentally aware of and fully conscious of what we're doing as we're doing it. It's living in the present moment, not in the past, not in the future, but right now. In this moment. It seems very simple. In fact, it seems too simple. So the Buddha provided a way for us to investigate and then to develop this ability. We call it mindfulness meditation. It's a practice. It's not very different from practicing to play the piano. And like playing the piano, the more frequently and intently and ardently we practice, the more enhanced our ability to remain mindful during all of life's trials and tribulations. Superficially, it would seem that we are aware of what we're doing all the time. But are we? To provide insight to the answer to that question, let's consider the meditation period that just ended. Were you able to remain focused and concentrated that whole time? Or did the mind have a tendency to kind of wander off here and you'd have to bring it back? Or wander off there and you'd have to bring it back? That's the norm. We stay very intensely aware of those sensations of the breath and of the body for a few moments, and then something happens. The mind wanders off, and all of a sudden we realize that we're no longer on the breath or the body. And often we don't even know how we got over here. Okay? We just realize at one point, oh, we're not on the breath anymore. And then the instructions are always to very calmly and dispassionately and without any judgment bring the mind back to the breath, to the body, to the sensations. The initial period when we are aware of the breath is a period of mindfulness. The period when we actually realize that we're no longer on the breath is also a period of mindfulness. The intervening period, before we realize that we've strayed away from the breath, is something very different. We're not asleep. We're not unconscious. Rather, we're in some regime of consciousness that's controlled by conditioning and habitual thinking patterns that have been developed throughout our life. In his book, Wherever You Go, There You Are, Jon Kabat-Zinn puts it this way. We tend to be particularly unaware that we're thinking virtually all the time. The incessant stream of thoughts flowing through our minds leaves us very little respite for inner quiet. And we leave precious little room for ourselves anyway, just to be, without having to run around doing all sorts of things all the time. Our actions are all too frequently driven, rather than undertaken, in awareness, driven by those perfectly ordinary thoughts and impulses that run through the mind like a cruising river, if not a waterfall. We get caught up in the torrent, and it winds up submerging our lives as it carries us to places we may not wish to go and may not even realize we're headed for. Meditation means learning how to get out of this current, sit by its bank and listen to it, to learn from it, and then use its energies to guide us rather than to tyrannize us. This process doesn't magically happen by itself. It takes energy. We call the effort to cultivate our ability to be in the present moment practice, or meditation practice. So let's talk about this practice, this mindfulness meditation practice. As we try to remain mindful, there are a number of roadblocks and obstacles that hinder our progress, things that keep us from being alert and fully present. The Buddha broke them down into five general categories, which he called the five hindrances. There are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor constitute the third, agitation and restlessness, the fourth, and doubt, the fifth. Now these overlap and coexist and leave many nuances, and the order in which they're given is not a hierarchy. It's just a list. So the remainder of this talk, I'm going to be looking at each of those hindrances, discussing ways to work with them, and actually use them to enhance your practice, as opposed to being an obstacle. So let's start with sensual desire, which is wanting everything that comes through the sense doors to be pleasant and agreeable. During our meditation period, did any of you feel too cold or too hot? At some point, was there a cramp in the leg or itchy nose? Were you squirmish, fidgety, uncomfortable, plagued by tingling sensations or itches or impulses to move or to wiggle? If we struggle with these sensations, try to make them go away, we can be they can be significant obstacles to our meditation. Another approach is to take them lightly and with gentleness and acceptance. See them as just another passing stage that the body has gotten itself into. You don't struggle, but rather look squarely at these urges and be curious and try to know them. In that way, these urges become aids to help deepen our understanding of who we are. We gain insights into the feelings and sensations and urges that often control us in so many ways. Notice what the urge does when you look at it. Does it go away? Does it increase in intensity? Or does it stay the same? If it intensifies and you just have to move, then move mindfully, noticing those sensations, noticing how the original thing, the original sensation that drove you to move in the first place or to scratch, notice how that subsides. Notice in general how things just tend to come into our field of awareness and last for some period of time and then goes away, only to be replaced by something else that comes up in our field of awareness. It's all part of this dance of life. Things come, they last, they go. Other things come, they last, they go. The Buddhist nun, Ayaya Kahima, in her book, Who Is Myself, has this to say. Everything that comes to us through our senses comes from the world. But the inner experience that comes to us through meditation is not dependent on worldly matters. Excuse me. Once we're able to experience the joy of full concentration, we find that this in itself is an automatic antidote to desire. If the mind is one-pointed, no worldly desire can enter. The more often we're able to achieve this one-pointedness, the less we will have to struggle against our longing for food, comfort, warmth, or whatever else it may be that we want or do not want. All dukkha comes from desire, and the more we want something, the more dukkha we have. Even to think I want a good meditation is a worldly desire. Our desires are related to the belief that happiness comes through our sense contacts. We all, of course, have happy moments, and that is as it should be. But when we continually search for those particular sense contacts that we imagine will bring us gratification, we block our path to meditation, to purification, to the way out of dukkha. As long as we are immersed in desire, we are immersed in suffering. This is totally unnecessary. All we have to do is let the desire go. It's easily said, but not, of course, so simple to do. It's a matter of understanding and willpower. And I'll add that I have found that the greater the understanding, the less willpower is needed. Okay. It's like having this thing that you've been carrying around and thinking that you so desperately had to cling to, that you needed. But with understanding and wisdom, you see that that's just not so. Okay? And to the extent, and when you see that, it's not a matter of trying to force it out of your life. You just drop it like a hot coal. It's not a matter of willpower at all. It's a matter of wisdom at that point. The next hindrance is ill will, which can be directed either inwardly or outwardly. If after the thousandth time noticing that your mind has wandered off, and you start to get down on yourself, you know, thinking that you should have more control than you do, starting to get angry, frustrated at yourself, it's obviously inward directed. On the other hand, you might notice that the person next to you is breathing so hard that your mind keeps wandering over to that sound. You want them to be quieter. The loud breathing is a big distraction for you. The person next to you becomes a demon, preventing you from having this good meditation, keeping you from your blissful state. You wish they would shut up or leave. You're mad that they sat next to you. This obviously is outward directed. And I smile as I read this because often I teach classes actually in a hospital setting. In one particular hospital I'm in a huge conference room that they've got partitioned with these kind of paper thin walls. And we're in one little section trying to meditate often, you know, trying to be quiet. And it's like folks in another section of this area, it's like they're like having a party, just laughing and talking and just having a good time. And it's so interesting because these are typically new meditators. And it's so interesting. I tell people, you know, just notice the noise and let it be part of the flow and let it go. And invariably, the first few times I get at the end of the meditation, I hear a lot of ill will directed toward the folks in the other room. Now, our way of dealing with this hindrance really is to look at it head on, as I was telling the people in my group. You notice your anger. You notice your frustration. And let these sensations be objects of your meditation. Allow yourself to really feel them. Bring to awareness the tension and the tightness in the body, the aversion in the mind. Really examining what's happening to your internal landscape. Not from the standpoint of making anything different, but rather from the standpoint of observing how you experience anger and frustrations and how it develops into ill will. Consider it a valuable opportunity, again, to learn about yourself. These are lessons that no one else can teach you. No one. It's really a gift. Approached in this way, you eventually learn that the noise, the ill will, the frustration, the anger are all part of the dance of life. It comes into existence, lasts for a while, and then it goes. clinging to or trying to push these mind states out of existence is not warranted or successful. Really only leads to more dukkha. All you need to do is let things unfold as they will. And as they do, remain detached and just watch the flow. Now, after all your attempts to accept and be with and observe your ill will, you're still enthralled in its tentacles, and it has control of you. There's another approach. Ill will is one of what the Buddha calls unwholesome roots. But we have three, greed, hatred, and delusion. But we also have three wholesome roots, love, generosity, and wisdom. You can counterbalance the ill will by love and generosity. In his book, The Experience of Insight, Joseph Goldstein puts it this way. A specific way of dealing with ill will when it's too overpowering is to generate loving thoughts, wishing happiness and love to all beings everywhere. To the individual people you feel very kindly towards. And finally, to the specific person you may be angry at, surrounding that person with loving thoughts, even though at the time it may be difficult. Slowly the anger will dissipate, and the mind will again become cool and balanced. Now, there's an old Cherokee story, I think, that points out this fact very clearly. It happens that an elder Cherokee was teaching his grandchildren about life. He said to them, "A fight is going on inside of me. It's a terrible fight. And it's between two wolves. One wolf represents fear, anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, competition, superiority, and ego." The other stands for joy, peace, love, hope, sharing, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, friendship, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. The same fight is going on inside of you, and inside every other person too. They thought about it for a moment, and then one of the children asked, "Which will win?" The old Cherokee simply replied, "The one you feed." The next hindrance, sloth and torpor, sleepiness and drowsiness, connotes the ability of our mind to fog over as a means to remove ourselves from situations and events we don't want to deal with. I don't know anyone that's not had that hindrance surface many times. Is there anyone in this? No. I can still make that statement then. We sit down to meditate and we're full of vim and vigor. And then all of a sudden we become sleepy and start to nod off. Okay. Just as with the prior two hindrances, as well as the ones that will follow, the best approach for dealing with it is mindfulness. To observe our body and mind carefully. To bring into our field of awareness. To penetrate into it. To notice how we feel, what thoughts come to mind, our emotional states. Notice what's intense in the body and what's loose, what's energized and what's not. Noticing how we know the difference between energy and lethargy. In this way, we learn about one way we habitually respond to some aspects of our lives. The more we learn, the more options we see. The more options we see, the better able we are to deal with this mind state, whether it surfaces in during meditation or in personal relationships. And the better able we can deal with these states, the more we're responding to life situations from a place of wisdom, as opposed to being controlled by habitual responses. If the mindfulness doesn't work, we just can't keep the head up or the body from slouching over, then there are other things that we can do. We'll try opening the eyes. This additional stimulation of the senses may be all that's needed. Another approach is to do the meditation from a standing position, or to do a walking meditation. The general idea is to do something that will provide additional stimulation to the body. But if in the end, all of this doesn't work, and the body-mind is probably just physically tired. Okay, and the prescription there is just rest. Okay, and do the meditation at another time. However, it's important to note that you shouldn't do that first. That should be the last thing you try. If it's the first thing, it's going to be a real repeating pattern. The mind's got you. You know, you sit down to meditate, you'll be tired, you go to bed. You never will meditate. Okay. So, try these other approaches first. We'll move on to restlessness and agitation. These comprise the fourth hindrance, and in many ways it's closely associated with boredom. We don't want things to be the way they are right now. We want to be doing something else. Okay, we want to be somewhere else. The best antidote for this is just to force yourself to stay put. I refer to it often as just sitting in the fire. And see what happens. This maintains non-judgmental awareness of your inner landscape. In his book, A Gradual Awakening, Stephen Levine has this to say. We see the thought, I am too restless to sit. but we allow ourselves not to act on the mind's intention to get up and distract itself. It's useful to sit and watch the mind seek satisfaction in attempt to elude the unpleasant. So we sit and watch the restlessness. Restlessness becomes a meditation. Actually, it can be a phenomenally interesting meditation to watch restlessness, because restlessness and boredom are difficult aspects of the same agitation in mind, which repeatedly wishes to get up and do something to fulfill its desire. But when restlessness and boredom can't force us to act, when we have allowed change to replace even these discomforts, then the chain of blind desire into blind action begins to disintegrate. This last sentence, I think, is very, very important. I think the link between blind desire and blind action is germane to all of the hindrances and to mindfulness in general. By allowing ourselves to sit with discomfort without acting on it, we are cutting the strings that uncomfortable mind states use to control our actions. How many times in your life have you reacted impulsively to some internal desire, only later to regret what you've done? Seeing through the delusion of unconscious desire frees us. It enables us to bring more wisdom into actions we take. Actions undertaken from a place of wisdom bring more peace to the mind and body and helps us out of the rut of samsara. The final hindrance is doubt. Am I just wasting my time? Why am I doing this? Meditation isn't going to help me. Might be good for other people, but not for me. In some ways, I think doubt is the most powerful of the hindrances, because when it grabs hold of you, you don't even try. It's like the path to freedom is still there, but we don't take it. Again, the most effective way to deal with this is just to face it and not identify it with it. It's not self or me or mind. It's just a thought. And as such, it'll pass away. Another way of dealing with this is to develop a good intellectual understanding of the Dharma. We can know that from our own experience, our own understanding. With this understanding, we're less likely to just give up. We know that there's a long history of thousands of years of people going through this process successfully. Let me read another section from Who Is Myself. We also have to drop the idea of perfection, the tightness of wanting. In fact, we have to drop all ideas and just be there. Doubt makes it very difficult to have complete commitment and dedication to the spiritual path. And without these, the path will be stony indeed. Doubt makes us go from one teaching to another and makes us unable to commit ourselves to any of them. Again and again, we abandon what we have begun and try out something new. To be committed means to give ourselves fully. And to do this, we need to have found confidence within our own hearts. The hindrances constitute very deep drives that we all have. In order to understand their nature, we have to set aside some time each day to meditate. Meditating some of the time, a few days a week, doesn't really do it, I don't think. Because under these circumstances, we only do it when certain qualities of mind are present. We don't do it when we're distracted. When that's so, you only experience an easy mind. You don't see and therefore cannot learn from a mind that is uncomfortable, a mind that's restless and agitated, a mind that's bored, a mind that wants to be somewhere else. It's really by sitting with these hindrances, these particular mind states, that we develop the ability to overcome them. And I'd like to close with a poem by Jennifer Payne Wellwood. It's called Unconditional. Willing to experience aloneness, I discover connection everywhere. Turning my face to fear, I meet the warrior who lies within. Opening to my loss, I gain the embrace of the universe. Surrendering into emptiness, I find fullness without end. Each condition I flee from pursues me. Each condition I welcome transforms me and becomes itself transformed into its radiant, jewel-like essence. I bow to the one who has made it so, who has crafted this master game. To play it is purest delight, to honor its form, true devotion. Can we sit for just a moment? Thank you for your kind attention. We have just a very few minutes for questions, if there's any. Jennifer Payne Wellwood. It's called Unconditional.
This is not so much a question as ask for commentary. When you said something about in your talk on doubt and suggesting that an intellectual understanding of the Dharma can be a help, I often find sometimes that doubt arises for me when my intellectual understanding doesn't match up with my experience on the sitting. And I know that that's in part that there's not enough sitting. But if you have any commentary about that kind of conflict.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I would suggest in that situation is to just be very curious about this disconnect, okay? this is what's going on for me, this is what I've read that, you know, has been a lot of other folks' experience, and you know, this is what other folks have happened, and this is what's written, okay? And just be really curious as to what's going on with you. Just looking, again, without judgment, without, you know, with acceptance of what's there, full acceptance that, hey, this is where I am. But being curious about what's really happening inside. And curiosity is a very significant motivator in terms of encouraging us and moving us in new directions. Okay. I think we are out of time, and so I'll be around if anyone has any further questions. But again, I thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.